This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Many state lawmakers fear coming up with a budget will be so very difficult in an election year. One candidate for governor is not worried.
Well, you have to build coalitions where you can. You have to find people of goodwill on both sides of the aisle who are willing to talk with each other. And you have to be bold about what success looks like.
Hear State Senator Daniel Biss talk about the state of the state and a way forward. Plus, For the Loyal, a play, Laura Kennedy has that story. A recent Lincoln quote in the governor's State of the State address is bogus. All that and more on Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. One of the Democratic candidates for governor is scoffing at the positive tone struck by Republican Governor Bruce Rauner in this week's State of the State message. State Senator Daniel Biss of Evanston says Rauner's speech appears to be given by someone who does not appear to have been paying attention to state government. Biss says Rauner acted as though there was no two-year budget impasse and as though people are not leaving the state of Illinois.
Acted as though everything was fine. What we need is a reset. What we need is a state government that actually works, and a state government that works for ordinary people in Illinois who have been left behind for way too long.
Isn't that what a governor is supposed to do, though, is to point to their achievements and to say, we are better than we were?
I think a governor is supposed to explain how we're going to be better than we are. And this speech was so divorced from reality that the only thing I was wondering is, where is this coming from, as opposed to thinking, hey, how can we work together to get where we need to go?
State Representative Dan Brady says that this will be another difficult year to find consensus on a budget. It is an election year, and the Democrats, he posits, will not want to give Governor Rauner any sort of achievement at all with which to use in a campaign. So the negotiating will have to be among the rank and file in the House and Senate leadership. What is your take on that dynamic?
Well, unfortunately, the tradition has been that during election years, not a lot gets done. I don't think we can afford that. The people of Illinois are hurting. People have been left behind by a state government that's only working for a few, only working for the wealthy, only working for the connected. And it's time for us to get past that. I'm running for governor so that next year, we'll have a governor who's on the side of ordinary people, but I'm not prepared to wait that long, and I intend to spend this legislative session doing my best to shake us loose from this inaction and finally get the state government working for people again.
So how do you do that? What are the tactics to use?
Well, you have to build coalitions where you can. You have to find people of goodwill on both sides of the aisle who are willing to talk with each other, and you have to be bold about what success looks like. Part of the problem is we have allowed ourselves to accept the idea that the only thing we can do going forward is the things we've done in the past. And if that's what we have to live with, then we're going to have to live with a government that's the same as what we've had before. But it's time for us to be bolder. It's time for us to change what's possible. And I spend every day that I'm in Springfield trying to build new coalitions to enact progressive legislation that, frankly, the state has needed for a very long time.
Last year, a bigger grand bargain than past collapsed at the 11th hour and 59 minutes. And that would have included workers' comp, but depending on who you talk to, it just wasn't going to happen for various reasons. What does a bold look at success look like this year? Is it a similar grand bargain that includes a lot of things for both parties?
I think we ought to start by looking at the places where we can agree. Instead of trying to find the places where we disagree the most and then somehow take one from each column, let's look at the things we can actually agree on. Let's look at the fact that both parties claim to want to support public schools adequately. Let's look at the fact that both parties claim to want to bring property taxes down. We know that property taxes are way too high in Illinois. And let's use that alleged consensus to build real policies around property taxes and school funding that actually accomplish what the people of the state of Illinois have for a very long time needed and deserved.
The parties can agree on a $1 to $3 billion deficit. How do you fix that in an atmosphere that is not producing a whole lot of new revenue?
Well, we need to fix our tax system. We've got a tax system that was designed for an economy we don't have anymore, and so what it's working for right now is the very wealthy. Illinois is a rough place to be a middle-class homeowner like me. It is an easy place to be a billionaire. And it's time for us to repeal the flat tax provision of the Constitution so we can finally ask the wealthy to pay their share. It's time for us to look at the real economy out there in Illinois and say, the money has gone to the top. That's where our tax system needs to follow.
Yeah, progressive income tax is something you are campaigning on. That is not a quickly accomplished fix, even if there is eventually consensus or at least a plurality for it. What short of that can be done to tackle that $3 billion or $1 to $3 billion in Reading next year?
Oh, I think we need to think of all options. I support legalizing the recreational use of marijuana, which if we were to tax that could bring in revenue. I support taxing financial transactions at the Board of Trade in Chicago. That's where the economy's gone. That's where the activity is, and yet it goes totally untaxed. If we were to tax that in a reasonable, fair way, that would be billions of dollars. We have to be creative, and we have to be open-minded, but we have to design our plans based upon the knowledge that the very wealthy will have to pay their share if we're going to have a government that finally works for the rest of us.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're here with State Senator Daniel Biss, who is running for governor. He's currently, by some polls, in second place, although first and second place don't matter a whole lot right now because there's still 38% uncommitted and a slew of candidates. So what does this snapshot, less than 2 months out, give you as a takeaway?
We are excited to be surging in this campaign. We were excited to see a poll come out yesterday that shows my campaign surging into second place as the other campaigns are all falling. And we're not surprised. I was so excited to be endorsed by MoveOn.org and Our Revolution just last week. Excited to have tons of new volunteers and new energy, lots of small contributions. I feel that people are coming to our campaign across the state of Illinois. And I think it makes sense why. The voters of Illinois are being confronted with a choice between a billionaire and a middle-class progressive, and I think that choice is pretty easy for most people.
You are picking up a lot of discrete endorsements by various organizations. You're not picking up as many union endorsements. So what do you do to appeal to them?
I was really excited to be endorsed by the only national labor union that has made an endorsement in this race. Just last week, National Nurses United, a large and fierce union, one of the most passionate and effective fighters for universal health care in the whole country, has jumped on board with our campaign, and we'll keep on working with all of our friends in organized labor. I think that the momentum we've built up of late is incredibly meaningful when it talks about what the members and leaders of unions are going to be doing, and I think there's going to be more good news to come.
That's one, but many more unions have gone with J.B. Pritzker. Why do you think he's appealing to them in a little more robust way than you?
Well, I think there's a lot of anxiety in parts of the Democratic Party about what to do about Bruce Rauner's money. And so there's some people who feel that the solution to Bruce Rauner's money is for us to find our own billionaire who can fund our side's campaign. I think that's the wrong way forward. I think that as Democrats, we should be for elections and not auctions. But I understand that organizations that need to beat Bruce Rauner want to first make sure that anyone who they endorse has got the tools to do that. And what I'm really excited about is the campaign that we've built that is showing the state that if we are the nominee, Bruce Rauner is going to have no chance, because the kind of passion that exists across the state, the fundamental contrast that I present with Bruce Rauner is something that nobody else in the race can present, and that's something that money can't buy.
We've talked a little bit about the budget situation. One key element of that is the pension system unfunded obligation. The courts have spent the last several years closing off some options for lawmakers. Lawmakers have passed a variety of measures that water down pension systems for new employees. That leaves the unfunded liability still largely intact for current employees. What do you suggest is a legal way to deal with that?
Well, I'm glad you said legal, because I think there are still some people in Springfield who would want to act as though the Supreme Court hasn't said what it said. But that's an irresponsible way to act, and I think that we ought to take the Supreme Court seriously and understand that pensions are a promise. Now, that means we've got to fund the pension systems properly every year, not sometimes, not just when it's politically convenient, not just when we're avoiding a recession, but every single year. By the way, there's one pension system in the state of Illinois called the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund. That pension system's in good shape because every single year the employers make the required payment. So we have to institutionalize that, make the payment now on the front end so that we can provide the promised benefits, and make the bold changes needed to our tax system so we can actually afford it in a way that allows us to also afford the kind of public services that the people of Illinois need. It's doable. The money's there if we are willing to have the guts to tax the people who have been funding the campaigns and have been far too powerful for far too long. It's time for us to finally build a tax system for a modern economy.
Yeah, short of a tax system, what are some other ways to chip away at it that, you've suggested? You've suggested consolidating pension systems.
Well, that's a great example. There are over 600 pension systems here in the state of Illinois. That's the second largest of any state in the union. Bloomington's got two, one for firefighters, one for police officers. So does Normal. So does almost every other community in the entire state. Almost no other state does it that way. And as a result, we have tremendous inefficiencies and lower investment returns and, to be honest, opportunities for corruption as well. If we were to consolidate those, you wouldn't touch anyone's benefit. There would be nothing in it that would be not only unconstitutional, but equally importantly, nothing that would be unfair or that would anyone could object to. And it would save significant dollars. And that's the path that we ought to be pursuing. Ways to make the pension payments affordable, that are constitutional, that are fair, and that don't take away promised benefits.
How much extra money could be derived to go toward the unfunded liability from consolidation in the efficiencies that you're saying could be created?
Well, for that specific example around consolidation of fire and police pension funds, obviously there's a transition period, but in the out years it would be first tens and eventually hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
So it tends to lessen the nut that the state taxpayers have to include every year.
Yeah, it simply lessens the cost, which leaves more room to, for example, hire more firefighters.
State Senator Daniel Biss, running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Biss stopped again in the Twin Cities to meet with ISU College Democrats, a constituency he says is very important, not only to the future of the Democratic Party, but particularly needed in this election year. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Laura Kennedy has a report on a new, troubling, disturbing, and important play being put on in the Twin Cities. President Donald Trump's administration has been in power for a year now. In the State of the Union speech, Trump again advocated for fossil fuels, issuing a call for more clean, beautiful coal. IPR's Mary Hansen talks with Phil Gonnett of the Illinois Coal Association about how Trump's policy is affecting the industry.
In the last year, we've seen our coal production increase modestly, about 10%, and that's after a decline of about 25% over the prior 2 years. The changes made by the Trump administration by either revoking, repealing, or rolling back some of the changes or the regulations that were promulgated under the Obama administration have kind of stabilized the coal industry going forward. And I know the term had been used quite a bit, that Trump was going to bring back coal. Unfortunately, that's just not going to happen. The major piece of legislation or regulation that he has stopped is the Clean Power Plan. And what that's going to do is, going forward, it's going to prevent the closing of more coal-burning power plants. We're not going to get back to the coal production where we were in this country back in 2008, which was 1.2 billion tons.
As you said, Trump talks about bringing back the coal industry by getting rid of a lot of rules. Here he is signing a resolution that rolled back protections for streams and waterways from coal ash waste.
This is HJ Resolution 38, and that will eliminate another terrible job-killing rule, saving many thousands of American jobs, especially in the mines, which have been promising you, the mines are a big deal. I've had support from some of you folks right from the very beginning.
Many environmental groups, including some in Illinois, have raised concerns about this. What's your response?
The purpose of the rule was to protect streams in Appalachia, where there's a form of mining called mountaintop mining, which you literally blow the top of a mountain off and remove the coal seam. We don't have mountains in Illinois. We don't have the problems of mining and filling in streams in the state of Illinois like they do out east. And the regulations would have made it difficult, if not impossible, to obtain a coal mining permit in the future.
In that clip we heard, and in other speeches, the president has promised to save mining and coal jobs. What's happened to those jobs in Illinois in the last year?
The actual job numbers in Illinois, we lost 119 jobs from January 1st through September 30th. Now, we may have spiked up a little bit that last quarter. I haven't seen the final figures. They haven't been released yet by the federal government. But we probably will be pretty close to what we had for employment. We kind of expect that's going to happen. We did have one coal mine close down during the year. There's another one in the stages of closing. So we don't see any large increases in employment to come about. And the other thing, too, is our coal mines are very productive. And the equipment, the improvements made over the years that you can mine more with less people, and that's going to be the case going forward. So I don't expect any large increases in employment, but we will certainly keep the jobs that we have.
Will we see this resurgence of the coal industry in Illinois, or will it hold steady or decline?
I see it holding steady and perhaps improving a little bit. One of the other challenges we have are low natural gas prices. Natural gas prices over the years has been very volatile, and we expect those to increase. And as natural gas prices increase, coal plants will be put in operation, because what consumers want is the lowest price electricity out there, and for most of the time, it's off of coal. In Illinois, we have excess capacity, so I don't see us building any new coal-burning power plants. So what we're focused on is to maintain the fleet that's out there now.
That was Phil Gonnett of the Illinois Coal Association talking with IPR's Mary Hansen, looking at the effects of the first year of the Trump administration on Illinois.
If one phrase emerged in 2016, it was "elections matter." Be an informed voter and submit your questions for our 13th District Democratic Congressional Candidate Forum, February 6th at the Normal Theater. Meet the five candidates hoping to unseat Rodney Davis, get up to speed on their positions, and see how they handle your questions. Submit them at our website and then attend the forum at 6 p.m. at the Normal Theater, February 6th, or listen live or online at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from DoubleTree by Hilton, a full-service wedding venue for any size reception or intimate courtyard ceremony. Their professional team attends to all your dreams as you create a memorable celebration. Bridal suite and overnight group rates available. Ashley has the details at 309-661-7583. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, one of Governor Bruce Rauner's quotes in his State of the State speech didn't cut the mustard. More on that in just a moment. Sports and sexual abuse dominate headlines now, especially the scandal regarding Team USA gymnasts and the team doctor that abused them. Just a handful of years ago, it was the Penn State molestation scandal that shocked the nation. The Penn State story in particular inspired the latest show at Heartland Theater, The Moral Choices and Complexities of Sexual Misconduct and How We Respond to a Crime, reveal a disquieting look at loyalty. Laura Kennedy has more.
For the Loyal by Lee Bless was inspired by the Penn State Jerry Sandusky case. Directed by Kathleen Kirk and featuring actress Michelle Woody, the play focuses on a young married couple, graduate students with a baby on the way. When the husband stumbles across a secret that threatens to derail their future, he and his wife must decide between honesty and loyalty. Director Kathleen Kirk says reading the play was an intense experience, especially since the subject of sexual misconduct is so pervasive these days.
So when I was reading it, I was just enthralled and scared and fascinated with how do these things unfold? What is the right thing to do? What are the moral, in addition to legal, responsibilities? What are the actions that can be taken? And how does this affect the, how does this ripple out into the community and do a lot of harm? So what can be done to prevent it? Or what can be done to heal or make things better afterwards? And all of those issues were coming up as I was doing this reading.
Michelle, you were playing the key character of Mia, who is carrying a lot on her shoulders. Tell me about Mia and what she is facing in this role.
Mia's fascinating. Mia is a, you know, young grad student with a baby on the way, and she and her husband are trying to fit into this football culture at the unnamed Midwestern University, the place set at. When she knows that her husband has seen something, there's a certain way that she thinks he should respond, and he doesn't. And so I feel like Mia is our collective conscience working through the issues of what do you do when you find out about something like this? What, there are so many gut reactions, you know, do I go to anger and violence? Do I, you know, try for compassion? What do we do as a society? So I feel like the character of Mia is written as an outlet for some of those feelings that inevitably come up when we hear about scandals in the news like this.
Clearly, the playwright was inspired by the whole situation at Penn State. But then, of course, we have the news happening now with almost every single day. There's somebody else mm-hmm. who it's been revealed has indulged in sexual misconduct. So it's in the headlines every single day. That must be different from when you're trying to prepare for a role and it's not something that's related to what's happening in the news. Do the headlines that are coming through every single day distract you or give you really good ideas about what you want to do with this character?
I would say the headlines and the, you know, the continued Me Too campaign lends strength to what we're doing. I know that I feel that in rehearsals because this is not just, it's not just an isolated story. This is a story that happens all the time to many, many people. And it's something that I know I draw strength from when I'm looking into ways to play the character and express those emotions.
The play helps us look at sometimes the victim falls through the cracks mm-hmm. or is blamed or held suspect in some way. Sometimes the people who would step forward to protect the victim are silenced, as well as the victim being silenced. And all of those issues are in this play and are coming out right now, where the right now is saying there's a lot of Me Toos, and wouldn't it be great for the predators and the abusers and the harassers to get the blame rather than the victim, or to be encouraged to stop what they are doing, right? And that is coming out. How can that be done in the situation of this play and the complexities of that? How difficult it is.
So you're exploring truth in this play. How difficult is that exploration?
I think particularly for people who have been impacted by sexual abuse, who are survivors themselves or know survivors, it can be emotionally draining. But at the same time, it's incredibly empowering to be able to give voice to these feelings that you might not ordinarily be able to express, you know, just in everyday conversation with acquaintances. I think it is important to tell this story. I think it's one of the most important plays I've ever been a part of, and I'm very excited.
Yeah, I do feel like this is definitely a trigger warning play. Mm-hmm. And so when people came to auditions, I wanted to make sure they knew what they were getting into, and most of them had done some research. There's a 15-year-old boy who is the victim of the abuse, and 15-year-old boys came to audition and were cast. And when they inquired, I said, bring a parent. And so their parents were right on board, and it is double cast. Two 15-year-old boys will be playing the role alternating, so it's not too much strain on one, and they are both doing a great job.
Tell me about the rest of the cast, Kathleen.
Oh, it's a great cast. Nick Benson, who also works here at ISU, mm-hmm. plays Mia's husband, Toby. The boy is double cast. Will Lovell and Max Beck are sharing that role. Dave Lemon, who has been in Community Players plays and in Heartland plays before, plays Coach Mitch Carlson, and Rich Tenaglia, who has recently come to this area from Chicago, where he worked as an actor in Chicago, plays Coach Tanner Hale. So both of the coaches. Oh, and another wonderful thing about our cast is a lot of them have been on their high school football team.
Oh, so they're able to bring that experience.
They have a lot of football experience and or they are fans. And our cast is supplemented by some actual football players. And we had a football coach come in and teach us some football warm-ups, which will be visible and available to us, and supplemented also by understudies. So our football players and extra cast are understudying, which was good because we're in flu season.
And I think this play is going to run right around the time the Super Bowl
going
to be
right.
It's going to be airing. So
timely in so many ways.
Why does it have the title, For the Loyal?
Oh, excellent question. What do we mean by loyalty? Loyalty to the football program? Loyalty to each other in a marriage, in a human relationship? Loyalty to the truth? What is meant? And I think Lee Blessing has written the play For the Loyal. So if you were loyal to this idea or that football program, consider what you did in being loyal. So the play is a challenge in that way, but it asks us to define. I mean, there are conversations in the play about the term loyalty mm-hmm. and what we mean by it.
That's Kathleen Kirk and Michelle Woody. Heartland Theater's production of For the Loyal runs February 8th through the 24th. Due to strong language and mature content, it's recommended that the audience be ages 17 and up. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Heartland Theater is hosting a panel discussion on the issues of the play following the matinee performance of For the Loyal on February 18th. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Politicians have been quoting Abraham Lincoln for as long as they've been giving speeches. Republican Governor Bruce Rauner was no different when he gave his State of the State address on Wednesday. But as IPR's Dave McKinney reports, this time around, something went amiss.
Rauner invoked Lincoln at the crescendo of his annual address to state lawmakers. If both parties could come together to cut taxes and spending, Rauner said Illinois' future would be bright. And that's when he turned to Illinois' favorite son to drive home the point.
Abraham Lincoln once said, "The best way to predict the future is to create it."
After our story about the speech got put to bed here at WBEZ, I got a tip that the Lincoln quote wasn't actually a Lincoln quote. So I tried to get to the bottom of this.
Abraham Lincoln Bookshop.
Dan?
Yep.
This is Daniel Weinberg. If anybody in Chicago would know what Lincoln actually said or didn't say, I thought this might be the guy.
We do books in Lincoln, Civil War, U.S. presidents, and Americana, autographs and letters, manuscripts.
Okay, you get the point. This guy deals with a lot of Lincoln stuff, or, as he puts it,
and the detritus of history.
I had found my guy. So here's a quote again. The best way to predict the future is to create it. Is that a real quote attributable to Lincoln?
The first time that we see it used was in a 1963 book called Inventing the Future by a Nobel Physics Prize winner, Denis Gabor.
Okay, Denis Gabor, almost 100 years after Lincoln was assassinated. In the world of Lincoln scholars and enthusiasts, the alleged Lincoln quote Rauner used isn't a known commodity, at least as far as they can tell. So after the speech Wednesday night, I shot a Facebook message to one of America's top Lincoln experts named Harold Holzer. He's written or edited 52 books, nearly all about Lincoln. He wrote me back, "Be assured, the quote is a fake." On Thursday, I called him up.
Well, I cannot speak to what the origins of it, except to say that what its origins aren't, if you want to do that.
Yeah.
And its origins are not Lincoln.
Same response from Professor Rodney Davis, co-director of the Lincoln Studies Center at Knox College in downstate Galesburg. He wrote back by email and said he didn't recognize the quote either. That's when I thought I'd make one last try with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. It sits a few blocks away from the governor's mansion in Springfield. Technically, it's under Rauner's control. Even they couldn't verify it. In an email to me, their spokesman said there's no hard proof Lincoln ever said these words. But, quote, the sentiment certainly matches other things President Lincoln is documented to have said. The museum even sent me a couple of real Lincoln quotes that were kind of like Rauner's fake Lincoln quote. I wondered why he didn't just use one of those. The governor's press office initially told me they'd found the alleged Lincoln statement on multiple websites. But later yesterday, they got back to me and they actually thanked me for pointing out the governor's mistake. They also promised next time they would go to the experts first. Harold Holzer, the Lincoln author, says there's a lesson here, something you might teach to any aspiring writer in high school. Don't believe everything you read on the internet.
You can't just Google something and assume that the result is going to be 100% factual. No one should do that for any reason. A student, a governor's office, a radio station, or me writing about Lincoln. So that's the lesson.
Lesson learned. I'm Dave McKinney.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As we continue another tough slog through winter, it's a good idea to remind ourselves of the service bitter temperatures serve. Patrick Murphy tells all to Laura Kennedy on this edition of GLT's Grow.
There's no denying that winter can be brutally cold, but that brutality can actually be of service in the garden. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello there, Murph.
Good afternoon, Laura.
Thank you so much for being here. Today on GLT's Grow, we're going to talk about how the chill of winter can actually be helpful to gardeners. So when we're gritting our teeth and bundling up with six or seven layers, well, you know, there's actually something good that comes of that. We should remind ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. Mr. Frost has a lot of work to do while we're all inside, gazing on our property, gazing on our snow-covered gardens or the mud-covered. It depends on where you are right now in the Midwest. But there's a lot of things that are interrupted by lack of a robust winter, right?
So if we had a winter where it was always in the 40s, we'd think, hey, great, but that's really not so great after all.
Yes, because it touches every part of the life cycle that affects the world we live in, the world that we share the living things with. So one thing that I found really interesting in preparing to talk about this was the example related to the sugar maples, which are tapped for sap to make pancake syrup.
Like they do out at Funk's Grove.
That's right. That's right. In parts of Michigan, where they have wonderful lake effect weather, the western shores of Lake Michigan, Grand Rapids, Muskegon, all that, the sugar maples grow to be a couple hundred feet tall there because it's great lake effect winters. They have lots of snow, but it doesn't get super, super cold. But the ground stays covered with snow for a long time. And the typical winter conditions are what have created the bounty in that and many other areas. So I guess one way to look at it is to talk about what happens when we don't get this kind of winter. So we've had a winter so far where the month of January has given us some 40 and 50 degree temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
And if this was to persist into, reappear again late in February or even early March, where it's balmy spring temperatures, you can still get the cold weather. We've all seen this. You're washing your car in the driveway during the holiday break, and then when you go back to work, it's freezing cold again. Sometimes those brief periods of warm weather are what trigger the plants to release their sap, to start initiating bud and vegetative growth. And if that takes place and then it gets cold again, well, that's an adverse difference. And that can damage cells, not only in the plants, but in the insects that are important to the life cycle, particularly pollination.
Oh.
Right? So in this example with the pancake syrup trees, they noticed that the snow would start to melt around the base of these trees, indicating that late in the winter, early spring conditions are coming and the tree is getting ready to release its sap. So the sap farmer, property owner, is ready. There's no surprise. But what if that guy is out in Palm, or that gal or girl, a guy are out in Palm Desert enjoying a vacation, and their farm back home, they get 40, 50 degree temps for a week or two. There's nothing they can do about it. They might as well stay and enjoy their vacation. But that sap is going to slip away and go to waste. Or the tree is going to start to grow, because the trees will start to grow with the warmer temperature. They also start to grow because of the longer days. But it's a catastrophe, because that same issue of the loosening from warmth and then the tightening from the freezing, think about the cells that make up the little insects that spread the pollen around. So, yeah, the mosquitoes, the ticks, the fleas, and the aphids, they take a beating when it's really cold out, but that we want that. But we don't want all the moths and the butterflies and everything to take that beating.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show. For those who like to get their hands dirty, this week, the upside of winter chill. And you just mentioned my favorite thing about winter. What I like to do when it gets to be like 5 degrees below zero is to stand at my back door and say, "Die, Japanese beetle vermin underneath the soil. I know those grubs are down there." And hopefully something this cold, like we had right after Christmas, cold temperatures like that, can that get down deep enough to kill the grubs of Japanese beetles?
It can. It's supposed to.
That's the key.
Right. So I would answer that by presenting this scenario. And I bet you that many people have experienced this in the last month. You get the warm temperature and you see the ladybug all of a sudden. What the heck is he doing here?
Right.
What's she doing here? And then you see the little orange version of the ladybug, like or a corn beetle. Well, they've had an opportunity because there's some warmth from the shelter of the home that they've been hiding in, you know, the nooks and crannies of our construction, plus the air temperature heats up, and the insects are kind of on autopilot that way, you know, their physiology wakes them up. The same is true for all the buds on the trees.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you think about a lot of the adaptable or favorite landscaping plants in particular that are, you know, your flowering pears, your flowering cherries and stuff. For one, they're all the same family, but they encounter this early balmy weather by developing buds, which are only to be attacked with fire blight when the cool, wet spring comes. And some of that bacteria and the mold and such, it survives when they're freezing temperatures are not long enough.
Okay.
And it blossoms when it's cold and then it warms up. And if it gets cold again, it has to get cold for quite a while for it to kind of correct all that.
So really an extended period of really cold temperatures is what's best for our gardens.
It appears so.
Okay.
Because, you know, you got to think about all the beneficials. You know, so we mentioned the aphids, the ticks and the fleas and all that stuff. They're useful to other members of the food chain that consume them, but they spread some pollen, but not like the moths and the butterflies and the grasshoppers and stuff like that. And even the mammals are impacted by this.
Yes.
So I was discovering, as I was looking for information about how the water table is affected, we'll talk about that. But, you know, bears are woken up from their hibernation early only to be confronted with conditions that are not favorable for their hunting.
Yeah.
And you think of the snowshoe rabbit in parts of the country where winter came and it disappeared, and that snowshoe rabbit is made to be camouflaged with its white hair, and its adorable huge feet are made to run fast on snow.
No. Okay.
And when they don't have any camouflage to blend in with and they have no snow to run on, they're vulnerable. So then that living thing takes a beating because the proper winter conditions aren't lasting,
aren't
or
proper.
They never showed up at all.
Yeah. And it happens.
And so another thing that's kind of like, you know, the logic of it all, the lack of snow and winter rain increases soil erosion, and it decreases surface water, which leads to groundwater that fills up our aquifers.
Yeah.
10 inches of snow equals 1 inch of rain. So if we have this real conservative snow, and then the ground does freeze, and then we get lots of spring rains, and it's still cool out, a lot of that water just kind of runs around, and it's not absorbed into the earth to refill the aquifers, and all those empty pore spaces that are filled with air, which used to be filled with water. So it's important that we get our took us is frozen off for a while.
So we should just stop complaining about the cold and say, you know what? Grin and bear it. And, well, don't bear it. Put on several layers and then bear it that way.
Yeah, I'm guilty of this because I love the heat. I don't mind it, but for some reason, the cold, I have to bite my tongue a lot because it's easy to complain about it.
But it does serve its purpose.
It does.
And the snow as well. We should be glad of that in the garden. Okay, Murph, good information there. Now, next week on GLT's Grow, we're going to be talking about how the wind impacts your plants. If you've got a gardening question or problem that you'd like Murph to take on, we'd love to hear from you at wglt.org/grow. There's a form there. Fill it in. Send that along to us, and we'd love to feature that on the air. So submit your questions at our website now at wglt.org/grow.
This is Sound Ideas on Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The seven-piece Latin fusion band, the Brazilian Airs, add 50-plus pieces to their sound when they merge with the Peoria Symphony Orchestra for their annual Romance Concert. The Central Illinois-born and now Nashville-based group will play orchestrated originals with the symphony February 10th at the Peoria Civic Center Theater. Brazilian Airs guitarist Rico Johnson and vocalist Dove Benoit stopped by the GLT studios to talk with John Norton about this special Valentine's Mood Show.
Winter seems the time to go, leaving footprints in the snow.
So the song you're hearing is from the Brazilian Airs. It's called Blue October, and this is a song that's going to be orchestrated in the Peoria Civic Center Theater here on the 10th. So Peoria Symphony contacted you, right?
That's correct, yeah. George DeLuto, the maestro, conductor. We actually did a concert a couple of years back with Charles Yang, who's this great violinist that came to play with the symphony. And we were doing an outdoor concert on the riverfront of Peoria. Charles came up and actually sat in and played a few songs with us. So after that, George DeLuto came right up to the stage and said, "Hey, have you ever orchestrated your music?" And at the time we said no. But that'd be interesting. And then a few months later, he actually called us and said, "We'd love to have you as part of our symphonic season. Can you make it happen?"
What was your initial reaction when he contacted you and said, "I want to do this. This will be a cool blending of music"?
Total awe. I mean, just to be asked to do it is just an amazing thing. And, you know, we just jumped on the opportunity because you can't say no to that sort of thing. And it's been a real challenge, but a really good challenge. And we're really excited about it.
So it's all your original music that they're orchestrating?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's a really cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
Man, how many pieces are going to be in the band?
Over 50 plus instruments. And we'll use our band. Our band will be up front, which is we have a seven-piece band, Dove and I front, and we have five musicians in the Brazilian Airs.
Is that kind of intimidating? I mean, it's really different.
Yeah, it is. It's intimidating, but it's really exhilarating as well. To be able to hear these pieces that we've created become these symphonic masterpieces is just going to take to a whole new level, you know, just this totally different take on our music. And it's still there. The music of the Brazilian Airs is still very much apparent in the symphonic music.
Well, that's a question. What does orchestrating your music, which already has seven pieces, that's a decent-sized band in a club, but now you're getting 50 on top of that. What does that add? How does that change? How does that make your music bring out different elements of your music or songs?
Well, I think the key is keeping the Latin groove that we have, because that's kind of the hot sauce of our band. And the two orchestrators that have helped us do that, they've made sure that has happened. But it's almost like taking our music from, I've used this analogy, from two-dimensional to three-dimensional. Some songs, obviously, for the radio, our songs are usually about 3 or 4 minutes long. Now they're being stretched 6, 7 minutes with beautiful, lush intros, interludes in the middle, just amazing things.
Have Have you rehearsed yet with the Peoria Symphony?
No, we have two rehearsals scheduled.
Okay.
The concertmaster, Marcia Henry Liebenau, who is actually playing the first half of our concert, she's doing a Bruch romantic symphony. She just seems really excited about it because it is a different type of music than they're used to playing. And she's actually going to play one of our songs with us. I think the symphony is excited from the take of Marcia, and I think it'll be different for them and fun. To the bang, to the bone, everything
just fine since you've been gone. To the bang, to the bone, bone, bone. You're listening to GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton in the studio with Dove and Rico from the Brazilian Airs. Going to be playing with the Peoria Symphony Orchestra on the 10th. It's the annual romance concert. So when you're out playing, you kind of generalize it as Latin, but it's pop, it's kind of jazzy, it's kind of a bunch of different things. Are you doing sambas or bossas or, you know, cha-cha stuff? You're doing flamenco?
All of the
are
above.
You doing?
Yeah.
I mean, there's Brazilian rock too, and Latin can cover a lot of different
sure.
things.
Sure. Well, you know, John, when the band first started, we did primarily Brazilian rhythms. Sambas, bossa novas, but we've kind of morphed into this Latin fusion band now where we do boleros and we do cha-chas and we do actually some Spanish, kind of a Gypsy King flamenco type of feel. We still write bossa novas and sambas, but we've kind of, again, morphed into other Latin rhythms. So.
Have you talked with Scott Hall up at Columbia College in Chicago? He's the one that's orchestrating this whole thing. Are you in constant communication with him on how this is all being fleshed out?
Yeah, he was here. Actually, we had a rehearsal last night. He came down for that rehearsal. And I don't know if you know much about Scott, but he is an incredible orchestrator. He actually orchestrated, the great pianist Ramsey Lewis orchestrated.
For Ravinia?
For mm-hmm. Ravinia.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also... I'd be remiss if I didn't say we're doing 10 selections, original songs that we've written, but 8 of those Scott is orchestrating, but 2 of those pieces are being orchestrated by a local guy here, the jazz director of Illinois State University, Tom Marco.
Tom Marco. Oh, okay. Well, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's play another one of your songs. I wish we could play something that's orchestrated, you know, some kind of, we can't, but I want to give our listeners a feel for, that haven't heard the Brazilianers. God, there's hardly any anymore in Bloomington Normal, right? Everybody knows who you guys. So let's play Venetian Blinds right now. Let's give this just a little bit of a twist, okay?
Great.
Blinds reveal such a scrumptious sight, a specimen as fine as cordon bleu.
So Mark was part of it too. I did not know that.
Well, he actually co-wrote Blue October with Wayne.
Yeah, Rico.
And so, Rico, yeah, sorry. So, you know, he really was wanting to orchestrate that one specifically, and then we decided to do another song that we love off of the CD called The Encounter, and he orchestrated that as well. And actually, we were a little concerned about, you know, how is that going to blend with one orchestrator doing a bunch and then having somebody else? But it's perfect. It's beautiful.
Well, I saw the video on Facebook of you guys playing with Charles Yang, right? Mm-hmm. And you admitted you were a little dubious about the connection of Charles with you guys together, but it's really cool what I saw on there. And that, what's that slow part? There's just one, it's only a 6-minute promotional video, mm-hmm. right? But this is really slow piece in there. Do you remember what song that was? Because it is just beautiful. Let me play just a little piece of that right now. Okay.
It may have been Hotel California.
Was that part of Hotel California? Mm-hmm. Because that's there as well. Oh, I see. Oh, my God. I wish I would have seen that. That is beautiful.
Yeah, that was a really fun night, actually.
Because he was playing really slow, and then he really started picking it up later.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, you're listening to GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton in the studio with Dove and Rico from the Brazilian Airs. What are you doing in Nashville?
We're pursuing our music.
I mean, you're going where the music is,
yeah.
It sounds like. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
You're making a go of it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, we're connecting with some songwriters down there. The industry's all there, you know, the publicists, the agents, the everything. So we're making those connections now. We've just been down there a few months. Our fan base is still up here in the Midwest, but we want to create this thing in Nashville and play out of Nashville.
How long have you been in Nashville now?
Since last September.
What are you finding out about yourselves or the band?
Well,
I guess that's what I mean. What are you finding out about the band? Do you got what it takes?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I think. I really believe that our sound is unique. Even in Nashville, like there's a club that I went to last Monday night in Nashville that has a killer Afro-Cuban Latin band. You know, there's really amazing jazz players, obviously great songwriters there. But I think the fusion that we do, this fusion of Latin grooves with jazz and pop, I'm just not seeing many groups like what we're doing. So,
you know, I'm surprised. There's a kind of a happening jazz scene in Nashville, which you think country and probably even indie rock now, but I mean, do you guys play the Bluebird down there at all?
No, we haven't yet.
That's a goal. But yeah, there are, you know, I think a lot of people just think, oh, it's country western in Nashville. And that's really, I think, increasingly becoming not true. There's a lot of different musical genres, and any given night you can go out and see a variety of talent. And, you know, we're just excited to be there. And as Rico says, our music is different. People are always asking us, how do you describe it? And we kind of take pause and say, well, you know, it's this fusion, but really we always just encourage people to go on Spotify or go on iTunes or Pandora or YouTube and just check us out, because really the only way to know the Brazilianaires is to see or hear the Brazilianaires.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. It's Bloomington Normal's public media.